soundscapes and classical remixes, brooding electronics and late night improvisation, and an all-night edition of Night Tracks with immersive live music and a traditional Indian dawn rock. Search for the After Dark Festival on BBC Sounds now.
Now on Radio 4, for the last time this series, we're diving into the mind of the American humorist Simon Rich as more of his absurd stories are brought to life by a British cast, including Kieran Hodgson, Cariad Lloyd, Ajani Salmon and Ed Eales White. Tonight's episode takes us into the field of science and nature, but not as we know it.
Welcome to the world of Simon Rich.
Case study.
London, 1886. It is rare for a physician to encounter a specimen whose condition reduces him to tears. But some cases are so horrific that even a hardened man of science cannot help but feel his emotions stirred. What follows is a true account of the most appalling case ever observed by this physician, a case so rare and tragic that it haunts him to this day. The subject was first observed at a common Soho sideshow. He had spent his youth under the control of a cruel mustachioed showman who'd forced him to live inside a cage and display himself for profit. It was as if nature had conspired to riddle the poor creature with as many abnormalities as possible. The subject's given name was Joseph Merrick, but society had cursed him with a different appellation: the Elephant Man. It was determined by this physician that the subject deserved a better life, and so the poor creature was rescued from the showman and transported to the Royal London Hospital so that he might find a new beginning. The subject confessed to this physician that his greatest pain was in fact not physical, but emotional. A lifetime of solitude had robbed him of the social kinship most men take for granted. And so it was determined by this physician that a visitor should be brought to see the subject, and to that end, the physician's own wife, Anne, was enlisted. After being warned of the subject's vile condition, Anne was led into his hospital room. It is a testament to her poise and charm that she did not scream or recoil. Instead, she engaged the subject in happy pleasantries, and even consented to shake his hand, ungloved. It was observed that her presence seemed to elevate the subject's mood. Within moments of her arrival, the subject even managed a small smile, an expression this physician previously thought him to be physically incapable of forming. It was observed by this physician that the subject's hand gestures grew increasingly animated as he interacted with his wife. It was further observed that he made prolonged eye contact with her. It was generally observed by this physician that the subject seemed confident talking to his wife. As the minutes passed, it was observed by this physician that some of the subject's questions to his wife were pretty personal. For example, at one point the subject asked her about her sister and then spoke about his own sister in a manner that implied that they were going through similar situations with their sisters. It was observed by this physician that his wife seemed impressed by the subject's opinions about her sister. It was additionally observed that she laughed at all his jokes about her sister, even though she did not like it when this physician made jokes about her sister. It was noted that she seemed to find the subject's jokes hilarious. After observing much laughter by his wife, this physician ventured a joke of his own, to the effect that maybe his wife should get going, given that it was visiting hour, not visiting day. It was observed by this physician that his wife did not laugh at this joke, although it was objectively superior to the jokes that had been made by the subject, and that, evidently, his wife's bar for comedy was lower for the subject than it was for the physician. As the physician's wife exited the hospital room, she noticed a crude model of St. Philip's Church that the subject had built out of coarse strips of paper. The physician's wife praised the model, and the subject described it as an example of how
sometimes that which is ugly can grow to appear beautiful.
It was observed by this physician that his wife seemed impressed by the subject's comment, even though it was obviously a line. It was further observed that the subject's model of the church was not particularly good and was basically like something a child would do for school. And it wasn't like the subject was some great artist. He just glued together a few strips of paper. He'd probably only done it so he could say his line about how ugly things were beautiful. And it was observed by this physician that in general the subject was a bit of a prick. That night at home, it was observed by this physician that his wife brought up the subject all the time and seemed to be obsessed with him. When this fact was noted by this physician, his wife confirmed she thought the subject was
impressive.
When pressed for evidence of this notion, the physician's wife pointed to the
adversity
he had overcome. It was noted by this physician that many people overcome adversity. For example, some people work hard to become physicians, which requires one to go to medical school, a task considerably more challenging than sitting around in a sideshow all day getting free food just to hang out. It was stated by the physician's wife she intended to visit the subject again tomorrow. It was observed that she seemed more excited for this visit than she had been for anything in years, and that he hadn't seen her smile so brightly since the very first moments of their courtship, when they'd met at a garden party and he'd asked her to go promenading. It was observed by this physician that his wife seemed distracted all night. It was observed that she drank more than her usual one glass of wine. It was observed that she retired from the table early. It was observed that she went to bed without saying goodnight. The next morning, it was observed by this physician that his wife presented the subject with expensive art supplies, and that he in turn presented her with a drawing he had made of Lord Byron, a poet she had mentioned during her previous visit. When she professed amazement at his
great memory,
the subject made a joke to the effect that
an elephant never forgets.
It was observed that she laughed so hard at this joke that everyone in the whole hospital could hear her, including the physician's colleagues, who avoided eye contact with the physician, probably because they were embarrassed on his behalf, because his wife was laughing so hard at another man's joke that it was basically like she was having sex with him in front of everybody. It was observed by this physician that the visiting hours were over, and so he gave an order to the nurses to go from room to room enforcing protocol. Shortly thereafter, the physician's wife walked up to him and expressed disappointment that she had to stop talking to the subject in the middle of
a great conversation.
It was noted by this physician that it was weird that she wanted to keep hanging out with the subject. At this point, she laughed and said,
oh my God, don't tell me you're jealous.
Her statement was refuted by this physician, but at the same time, he did note that it was odd how much time she was spending with this guy she had just met.
This is crazy. What, you really think I'm attracted to the elephant man?
It was noted by this physician that it certainly appeared that way, given her actions and behaviour.
He's the most deformed person in history. Besides, he's clearly gay.
It was noted by this physician that his wife had no hard evidence that the subject was gay.
He wears a cape.
It was noted by this physician that A, the subject most likely wore the cape to cover his deformities, and B, capes no longer carried the same connotations they once did. There were lots of straight guys who wore capes, and he had read an article about it. Additionally, it was noted by this physician that the subject had been observed checking out her arse.
Oh, that's just the way his skull droops. I mean, his cranium is tilted downwards.
It was noted by this physician that he had never once observed the subject check out male arses, and that it was only her arse that seemed to make his cranium tilt downward.
What, so you watch him all day long and check to see which arses he looks at?
The question was posed by this physician as to whether she had ever once heard the subject say explicitly that he was gay, or mention a boyfriend, or anything like that.
He's not going to come out and say it. It's Victorian England. It's got enough going on.
It was noted by this physician that the subject seemed like a pretty open chap, and that if he were gay, he would probably be upfront about that fact, given that he was upfront about everything else, like his opinions on poetry and art and whatever the hell else he said trying to impress her during visiting hours.
Well, so I can't have any male friends, that's what you're saying. I have to live my life in total solitude because of your paranoia.
It was noted by this physician that she could be friends with whomever she wanted, but that she and the subject appeared to be becoming more than friends. And as evidence of this fact, he pointed out that she was wearing lipstick, which was something he'd never once observed her doing.
I wear lipstick all the time. You just never notice.
Over the next few weeks, It was observed by the physician that his wife had started sleeping in the downstairs bedroom. Meanwhile, she continued to visit the subject daily at visiting hours, frequently wearing new outfits, all of which, objectively, were designed to showcase her arse. It was further observed by this physician that she had lost at least 10 pounds and gotten into basically the best shape of her life. It was additionally observed by this physician that his wife had increased her correspondences and was writing and receiving messages constantly, and that even though she claimed she was writing all the letters to her sister, it was obvious that the letters addressed to his wife were written by somebody with a deformed hand. It was also around this time that the physician started drinking ether and cocaine. During an intense binge of narcotics, it was determined by this physician that the subject should return to the sideshow so that his interactions with his wife might cease. To this end, he walked down to Soho and explained the situation to the showman, who listened in silence while twirling his moustache. He postulated,
"It might be an emotional affair."
It was stated by this physician that he was unfamiliar with the term.
"It's where they're not having sex, but it still counts as a betrayal. Also, sometimes it leads to sex."
The question was posed to the showman as to whether or not he thought the subject was gay.
"No way. I mean, he might be bi, but he definitely had girlfriends. He was actually with one girl who was insanely hot."
The physician drank a bottle of cocaine. It was suggested by this physician that the subject return to the sideshow.
"Not a chance. The last thing I need is a guy like that around, trying to steal everybody's girlfriend. How did he even meet your wife in the first place? Isn't he confined to a hospital bed?"
It was admitted by this physician that he had been the one to introduce them.
"Are you for real? What were you thinking, man?"
It was noted by this physician that he deeply regretted it, and he had no idea what he was going to do, and that he was completely freaking out, and that he couldn't believe that they were doing him like this.
"You've got to put your foot down. You're her husband. Tell her she can't hang out with him anymore. And tell him the same thing. Tell him to piss off."
It was noted by this physician that if this ultimatum were issued, it could have the effect of driving them further into each other's arms. The showman shrugged.
"At this point, honestly, what have you got to lose?"
The decision was made by this physician to confront his wife and the subject at the next visiting hours. When he climbed the stairs to the subject's room, he observed that the door was closed and all the blinds were drawn. When the door was kicked open by this physician, it was observed that his wife was sitting beside the subject on his bed, a poetry book spread out over their laps. A statement was made by this physician to the effect that he was sorry to interrupt and that they could go back to shagging each other in a minute, but first they should know that he wasn't a fool, and also he couldn't believe that they would both do him like this. At this point, the wife of the physician began to apologise to the subject for the physician's behaviour. It was noted by this physician that she was the one who should be apologising for trying to shag the elephant man, and he reiterated again that he couldn't believe she was doing him like this. At this point, the shouting began to grow intense, and the physician and his wife grew increasingly loud until they were finally interrupted by the subject.
"Dr. Treves, this is crazy. There is nothing going on between us. Anne and I are just friends, and it's totally platonic. Anne, tell him."
It was observed by this physician that his wife seemed disappointed to hear the subject characterise their relationship in this manner.
"Yeah, of course. Who would ever be in love with me, right?"
It was observed by this physician that, despite her caustic tone, her eyes were damp with tears. It was further observed that the subject was growing frustrated.
"Okay, look, I'm not really sure what's going on, but you two obviously need to have a serious conversation to figure out what's happening with your marriage, because I feel like I'm just getting sucked into something here that has got nothing to do with me, and that's not fair. And I can't go outside because I'll be attacked by a mob, but I'm going to wrap my cape around my face so you guys can talk this out in private."
And when he put on his cape, it occurred to this physician that it was the first time in weeks he had talked to his wife one-on-one. And it was further observed that although they'd been married for years, they seemed almost like strangers to each other. And to break the ice, the physician offered his wife some of his ether, and she drank some right out of the bottle, in a quantity that suggested her tolerance had gotten really high, and that, like the physician, she had lately been consuming lots of ether. And after a long, fearful pause, the question was put to her by this physician as to whether or not she loved the subject.
I don't know. I thought that he loved me, and maybe it was wrong to seek that attention, but it was all I had.
And she noted to this physician that he had been neglecting her for years, and in many ways taking her for granted. And it was observed by this physician that she had a point, and that perhaps he had been too focused as of late on his career, and his case studies, and his perpetual hunt for specimens deformed enough to write about. And it was noted by this physician that his priorities had become displaced. And it was observed by each of them that, in some ways, they had both been at fault, and that although their marriage was in crisis, that did not mean that it could not be saved. And they related these developments to the subject, and he nodded and said that he had heard the entire conversation, because his cape was not particularly thick. And it was observed by this physician that the root of their problem was one of mutual insecurity. They both had assumed that there was something wrong with them that made them undeserving of their partner's love. And it was observed by this physician that perhaps at times everyone felt this way, like an unloved outcast. And when he said this, the subject rolled his eyes a bit, and the physician kind of backtracked and admitted that there were maybe degrees to which people felt like outcasts. But the point was that both the physician and his wife had felt lonely for some time. And so, they agreed to go to couples therapy, and they began to try new exercises, like doing a mandatory date night once a week, where they had to take turns asking each other questions that they did not know the answer to. And it was sort of strange at first, but over time, it was observed by both of them that it was also kind of fun. And gradually, their marriage began to regain strength, like a patient recovering during a lengthy convalescence. And one night, at some Italian place, she made a joke, and the physician laughed so hard that people looked over from other tables. And she began laughing as well, which made them both laugh more. And he observed that she looked just as beautiful as the day they'd met, when he'd first noticed her at that garden party. A specimen so lovely, it felt as if all of nature had conspired to create her. A creature so unique, it could stir the emotions of even the most hardened man of science. A remarkable rarity, amazing to observe, incredible to see.
Raised by Wolves.
In 2003, a group of hunters discovered a young woman in Siberia who apparently had been raised by wolves. Scientists were unable to explain the child's origins, but an examination indicated that she was approximately 18 years of age and in surprisingly good health, given her unusual upbringing. Researchers named the woman Lauren and worked with authorities to assimilate her into human society. With effort, Lauren managed to catch up to her peers, both socially and intellectually. By the age of 35, she had married an insurance actuary named Gabe and given birth to a healthy daughter. Lauren never again interacted with the wolves that raised her, except when they came over for Christmas. Lauren was debating whether to have a second glass of wine when her husband shuffled in, straining under the weight of a dead elk. He dumped the carcass on the coffee table, shattering several bowls of nuts and olives. Lauren sighed.
What's wrong?
I just don't understand why we always have to accommodate their needs.
Gabe shot her a scolding look.
Because they're your parents, and they're our guests.
Lauren downed her wine and refilled her glass up to the brim.
Listen, I get it. Parents are hard. Mine drive me crazy too. I mean, my dad, with all those puns, it's awful.
I think my parents are worse.
I know your mum and dad aren't perfect, but they came all the way from Siberia. The least we can do is be civil, right?
I guess.
Lauren smiled tightly as Gabe whirled around the living room, setting out the napkins and placemats. She'd told him all about her screwed-up childhood, the barking, the growling, the total lack of structure and support. Her parents had never been abusive, but it had still been a dysfunctional home. Her therapist had confirmed it.
They did not see you, and you were not heard.
Still, while Gabe was aware of her parents' transgressions, he had never actually witnessed any. Her parents had both mellowed considerably with age. Her father had stopped howling at the moon following his stroke, and after a few false starts, her mother had finally quit drinking.
Lauren knew she should be grateful for their progress, but somehow it galled her. By rehabilitating themselves, they had robbed her of an audience for her suffering. It was one more deprivation, the latest in a chain stretching all the way back to her childhood. Two piercing canine howls sounded in the distance.
Do you want to get the door?
You can get it.
Lauren took a deep breath as Gabe let her parents through the doggy door.
Sorry we're late. You know your daddy didn't want to ask for directions.
It's a good thing I had my better half.
Lauren cringed as her parents nuzzled. Growing up, her father had cheated on her mother constantly, with her friends, her neighbours, and once with a log that had a hole in it. And now everyone was supposed to pretend that their marriage was perfect?
So, how's everything? How's work?
It's fine. Yep.
There was a 2-second pause, and Gabe rushed to fill it.
Work's better than fine.
He smacked Lauren's arm with an annoying amount of force.
Honey, tell them your big news.
It's nothing.
It's not nothing.
Gabe turned to her parents and gestured at her like a game show host.
You are looking at Vodafone's newest regional marketing communications manager.
Lauren's parents tackled her and licked her face.
Oh, we're so proud of you.
Thanks.
So, what does this mean? You get to hunt bigger animals?
I'm not a hunter. I work for Vodafone. It's a telecommunications company.
Oh, gotcha. I'm sorry I got it wrong.
Well, that's great. I'm not surprised. We used to always say, there goes Lauren, our little genius.
What? Nothing.
It's okay. You can say it.
Well, I just don't remember you ever saying that. My memory, in fact, is that you never named me.
Her parents hung their heads.
Would anybody like to eat this dead oak's ass?
Thanks. I'm not really hungry.
Okay, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said anything. I should have remembered the family rule. Never say anything about anything uncomfortable, ever.
Lauren's father put his tail between his legs.
Maybe coming here was a mistake. Maybe we should just jump out of the window.
Wouldn't be the first time you left.
Sweetheart, we went over this in therapy. The reason I left the family had nothing to do with you. It was a period in my life when I was confused. I thought the log with a hole in it was your mother. I literally thought the wood was her body and the moss on it was her fur. It was a crazy time in my life. I had rabies.
So I'm supposed to feel sorry for you now?
Despite the whine, her hands were shaking.
We're not asking for sympathy. And if there's something you need to say to us, we're here to listen, right, darling?
Yes. We are prepared to honour your emotions.
Lauren clenched her fists. She hated it when they used therapy jargon.
Let's start with my leaving. Tell me why it makes you so upset.
Oh, I don't know. Maybe because it happened on my bloody birthday.
Her parents eyed each other subtly.
Let me guess. You don't remember?
Honestly, no.
Oh, so you're saying that I made it up?
I'm not saying that. It absolutely could have happened the way that you remember it. I'm just saying my memory is different.
Okay, fine. What's your memory of the day that you left?
Okay, well, and again, this could be inaccurate. We're talking about something that happened a long time ago, and my brain is the size of a pine cone, and I have no understanding of time or numbers. But my memory of that day is I was walking through the woods, and then the big yellow god that lives in the sky shined hot. And then there was a smell like, okay, time to go. And so I ran into the wet place that is cold, and again, that might not be a perfectly accurate description of what happened, but that's what I remember.
That's what I remember too.
There's no point in doing this. Every time, it just leads to frustration.
We're frustrated too!
Her father sighed and tried to calm himself down.
I'm sorry for growling just now. I was flooded.
It's all right. Go ahead.
Thank you. My point is, I know that we weren't great parents. We were young and we were wolves and we didn't always know what we were doing. But every time we see you, all we do is apologise over and over, and it's not easy. In order to do it, we both had to learn to talk English, and it hurts our throats and looks insane. If you want us to keep saying sorry in this strange human language, we will. Because we are sorry, but at a certain point, the ball is in your court.
The room fell silent, allowing them to hear a distant squeak. Gabe ducked out and returned a moment later holding their 3-year-old daughter, Haley. She was gripping a small orange ball, the source of the squeaking. Her eyes were bleary from sleep, but when she saw her grandparents, she let out a squeal and buried her face in their fur. Lauren was surprised that Haley even remembered who they were. She'd barely spent any time with them. There was the Christmas before this one, and that bank holiday when they'd flown her to Siberia because Gabe's sister was getting married and there were no children at the wedding and it was just the easiest childcare option. Lauren had expected Hayley to be homesick that weekend in the tundra, but somehow she'd managed to enjoy herself. It didn't hurt that her grandparents had spoiled her rotten. Lauren had asked them to limit Hayley's screen time, but they let her watch as many cartoons as she wanted. They claimed it was because they didn't understand what screens were and had no way of differentiating between an iPad and any other reflective surface like a puddle or an eye. Lauren suspected they were lying, but somehow she found herself charmed by their indulgence of her daughter. In their coddling of Hayley, she sensed a desire to make up for the past, a subconscious awareness that there were wrongs that needed righting. Hayley tossed her orange ball across the room, and her grandparents obediently fetched it. It was surreal to Lauren to see her parents so docile, but of course, to her daughter, it made perfect sense. She didn't see them as the vicious wolves they were. To her, they were just Nan and Grandad. Someday, she'd have to tell Hayley the truth about her childhood and the trauma she'd endured. Or maybe she wouldn't. Maybe she'd tell a different narrative, one that focused on the things they'd got right, how they'd fed her, sheltered her, and defended her from hawks. For all their dysfunction, she'd ended up turning out okay. In some ways, her parents' flaws had even contributed to her success. She knew, for example, that her essay about them was a major factor in her getting into Warwick. Hayley was about to throw the ball again, when instead, she walked over to her mother.
Now, Mummy, throw.
Hayley pressed the soggy ball into her hand. Lauren turned it over in her palm. It was hard to tell if the drool was her parents' or her daughter's. Hayley had some new teeth coming in. Lauren had recently brought her to the dentist, and the x-ray of her child's jaw had shocked her. There wasn't anything out of the ordinary, but it was disturbing to see all those adult teeth embedded in her skull, a lifetime of canines and molars waiting their turn to erupt. It would be years before the teeth broke through her gums, decades in some cases, with braces, retainers and extractions along the way. Why couldn't humans come out fully formed with everything they needed? Why did it have to take so long and hurt so much to finish growing up? She gazed at her parents, now crouching low on the carpet in a show of deference. In wolf years, they were 400 years old. She wondered what their upbringings had been like. They'd been raised by wolves too, of course. They'd never spoken about their parents, and it occurred to Lauren only now that she had never asked. She held up the ball, and her parents stared at it with tired yellow eyes. Their panting was laboured, but their pupils were focused, tracking the ball as she traced it tentatively through the air. She could hear them faintly whimpering, as plaintive as two pups begging for scraps.
Throw, Mummy, throw!
Lauren lifted the ball high, feeling its heavy, sticky weight. Then she took a deep breath and let it go.